Welcome to The Program, a podcast dedicated to exposing the institutional child abuse that occurred at the hands of WASP, or Worldwide Association of Specialty Programs, an organization that owned a network of dozens of schools that systemically abused at-risk teens and exploited their parents for millions of dollars. This podcast aims to expose those responsible and seek justice for the damage caused to the innocent children who endured unspeakable abuse. This podcast is for the survivors. I dedicate this to you. Welcome back to Inside the Program. This is your host, Caroline Lorson. Today, we have a very special guest, Haley Hedrick, and she is going to give you an incredibly personal perspective on how she resisted the program at the Academy at Ivy Ridge, which resulted in her being continuously and violently restrained. She recounts her time in solitary confinement and the mental and emotional aftermath that she still lives with today, 15 years later. Thank you to everyone who is supporting this movement and this podcast specifically. If you feel compelled to help support our cause, you can make a monthly donation. Any amount is appreciated, truly. Just click the support button on the Anchor app, or you are more than welcome to donate to our GoFundMe page, which is linked below in the description. Again, thank you. All of the love and support is appreciated. And if you're not in a place to make a monetary contribution, just share the episodes. Share whichever ones speak to you, whichever ones hit you the hardest. That helps us tremendously as well. So thank you again, and let's welcome Haley to the show. Hello, Haley. Welcome to the podcast. We are so happy to have you here, and I cannot wait to hear your story.
Hi, Caroline. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be able to tell my story on your podcast. I'm a huge fan.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So tell us, what programs did you go to and how long were you there for?
Okay, so I went to the Academy at Ivy Ridge from March of 2006 to April 2007. So I was there a total of 13 months.
Tell us, how did you get there? How did you end up at this program? I mean, I know everyone's stories, we have so much in common for just, you know, how it all went down, but give us that bird's eye view of what happened and how did you end up there?
Sure. I guess I should preface by saying that I was a little bit of a firecracker in my adolescence. My mom and dad divorced when I was about 9 years old, and my mom decided to go back to school. So she relied on me being the oldest to watch over my brother and sister and kind of take care of things. Eventually, just, you know, watching the kids while she went to school became watching the kids while she went on a date or watching the kids when she went out. You know, she was going through a divorce. She was trying to find herself. I get it. But it put a lot of responsibility on me. And I was 9, 10, 11 years old at the time. Mm-hmm. So by the time she, you know, kind of got over that, you know, phase, college was over, she found a job, she was kind of quieting down a little bit. She kind of came back more in the picture and was like, okay, now I'm going to ground you. And so I was like, oh, no, ma'am. I have been the one to, you know, take care of everything. You're not going to tell me what to do. So ever since then, it was like butting of the heads. Like, we were constantly, you know, fighting with each other. You know, it was constantly a power struggle of resentment and, you know, you owe me kind of attitudes. And it just kept, the pressure just kept really building and building. I did do, you know, I was really lonely and I was battling depression and mental illness at that point. So, I mean, I was in the meantime trying to find attention and you know, love anywhere I could get it. So I experimented with marijuana. I was dating boys that I had no business dating. So I think that was the driving force behind it mostly. Mm-hmm. Then it was just kind of everything was really leading up to it. It was just constant. There was not really any set incident that kind of was the last straw. It was just build up for years until I had turned 16. Mm. And that was just when she was over it.
You know, I think that that's such an understandable place to be in. You know, when a parent puts a lot of responsibility on a child and you kind of have to step into more of that adult role. And then if they go back on that and they're like, oh, wait a second, now I'm going to be an authority figure again. Now I'm going to change that role again. Right. And you know, I'm sure right. There could be resentment of like, wait a second, no, I've been picking up the slack around here. And now you're wanting to, for me to step back into that role of being a child. And I think that that can be confusing and create a lot of resentment.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, she was a newly single parent, was trying to figure out how to be both roles. And it was just nonstop. It was just battle after battle after battle. So
I got transported in the middle of the night. Paris Hilton's documentary actually kind of really struck a nerve with me because her experience with it was, so similar to mine. I had been struggling with depression for a while, and I had a really, really good day that day. My boyfriend at the time came over. We were playing basketball. Like, for the first time in a long time, I had felt really good. Mm-hmm. And so it was reassuring. I don't know. I just had this sense of like, everything's okay. Everything's good. This is such a good day. And then, so fast forward to the middle of the night, I'm supposed to be sleeping, but I'm on the phone. I wasn't supposed to be on the phone. So I was, you know, whispering. That made me hypervigilant to listening for footsteps. My mom had a tendency to get up in the middle of the night, to wake up in the middle of the night and, you know, walk around the house. So I didn't think anything of it. But then I started being more and more aware that she's up for an extended period of time. You know, I don't know if she ever even went to bed. Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, you know, I better get off of here, you know, get off the phone before she catches me and I'm grounded again. So I got off the phone, went to bed. I had the lights turned off. I don't even know how much time had passed. It couldn't have been more than an hour. I was still awake, but I was in that nice, you know, state in between sleep, you know, right when you're right almost to sleep. And the room was pitch black and I heard a knock on the door. And it wasn't like a police knock or anything. It was just a nice, you know, gentle knock. I figured it was my mom. And I said, go away, I'm sleeping. And then I don't remember the lights being turned on. I don't remember the door opening. I don't remember anything. All I remember is hearing a man's voice go, I know. And I instantly stood up in my bed. And then that's when the lights went on and I started freaking out and I was screaming. And how Paris described it, as they said, you know, you can do this the easy way or you can do this the hard way. Verbatim. That is exactly what they said to me.
Right.
So, I mean, I put up a fight. I did it the hard way. I was terrified. I didn't know what was happening. I thought I was being kidnapped. I thought maybe, you know, did my mom leave and she's not even here for all I know. I didn't know what was happening. So I put up a fight. I swung. I tried, you know, getting away. They cornered me and ended up handcuffing me and carrying me down the stairs. I would not stop screaming, I remember, until I said, where's my mom? And they said, your mom is having us do this. And then I looked up in the doorway and I saw her in the doorway of the house. We were, at this time I was in the car of, you know, the transporter's rental car. She was stone-faced. I mean, she wasn't crying. She wasn't, you know, she was just completely stone-faced and just watched. That was that. And we drove away. I didn't say a word after that.
Did they tell you at all, we're taking you here? Or did they give you any information about what they were doing or what you could expect?
I remember asking, where are we going? And they said, you're going to a school. And that's all I remember. I mean, I was pretty, again, I was a firecracker. So I know there was, you know, quite a few F-bombs being dropped at this point of, you know, I didn't want to hear it. I just wanted out. I was handcuffed to the headrest in front of me. I was sitting in the back seat. The female of the team was, you know, sitting next to me. And I remember being handcuffed to the seat. I remember feeling so uncomfortable because they did the handcuffs way too tight. So the metal was literally digging into my wrist.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't let me get dressed at all. So, I mean, I'm half dressed. I don't have a bra on. Like, they wouldn't let me put a bra on. So I'm so uncomfortable right now just being in public, like,
right,
you know, not dressed. I'm 16 years old. And, you know, so I just all around felt very, very uncomfortable.
You're already in a vulnerable situation, and then to feel exposed even more like that, I'm sure the entire experience was just distressing.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I don't have much memory of the ride, except for I know somewhere along the Massachusetts Turnpike, because I was living in Massachusetts at the time, and so Massachusetts to New York, we were going through the Massachusetts Turnpike, and I remember a state trooper pulled us over. Because the mail transporter was driving, and he was driving way too slow. You know, this was back in the day where there wasn't GPSs. I think they had, like, printed out MapQuest, you know, directions of how to get to Ogdensburg.
Right.
He couldn't figure out where he was going or something, but he ends up getting pulled over. And then, of course, the state trooper, you know, shines a flashlight in the back seat and sees a 16-year-old girl half-dressed, handcuffed to a headrest, screaming. So I know that things did not go as planned for them. We were held up for some time. So I know that made them very, very angry. Actually, the state trooper let us go, which is crazy to me, but the state trooper let us go on our way. And I remember the transporters being extremely angry because I was screaming for help. You know, I was still screaming. I saw a police officer. I was screaming, help me, help me.
Right.
So I know they were not happy about that. I don't remember anything else about that. They did not talk to me. I did not talk to them. Nothing. I think they stopped and asked me if I needed to go to the bathroom at some point, and I just was like, no, I'm fine. So that was pleasant. So I don't have any memory of actually pulling up to Ivy Ridge. I don't remember what the outside of the building looked like when I pulled up. I don't remember walking through the doors. My first memory of Ivy Ridge is being escorted by a dorm mom and two upper-level girls to the bathroom, and they did the intake there. I remember that intake because it was so degrading. They had us, you know, they had me stripped down naked, do jumping jacks, squat and cough. And I felt so embarrassed the whole time, so vulnerable, especially because I was like, oh, this is not a medical facility. These upper level girls have to be younger than me. They are at least the same age, but I'm pretty sure they were younger than me. And they're the ones standing here watching me. I remember that being my first thought of something's off here. You know, this is not a medical professional doing this.
Right.
And then I remember them making comments here and there during my intake, you know, about the clothes I had brought and stuff like that. My mother had packed me a bag with, you know, the standard sweatsuit that they put you in before you get your uniform and all that. So I remember them making comments and just feeling already so, you know, beaten down. As you know, Caroline, we, you know, when you are new to the facility, they give you a hope buddy. And your hope buddy is the only one that can talk to you, or you can talk to them for, 3 days or so?
Right, yeah.
And they're supposed to teach you the rules. Yeah, and they're supposed to, you know, teach you the rules and what not to do, what to do. And I remember just sobbing the entire 3 days, just being like, I want to go home. And so I wasn't even like, I was only half listening to the rules because I was just so, you know, full of my emotions, just in my feelings of, tell me how to go home. I just want to go home.
Right.
And
this can't be real. Right.
Like, yeah,
that's right. Part of the thought. And I remember when, you know, I was first there and talking to other people who were, you know, just started there, maybe in hindsight, you know, we talked afterwards. We were like, God, I didn't know that a place like this even existed.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think I was so confused because I wasn't sure, like, is this a psychiatric hospital? Is this, you know, a boot? Where am I? What is this? Right. I couldn't figure it out for a while. And I was in such shock, I think, too, that it just wasn't clicking. Nothing was clicking for me. I remember at that time being very, my hope buddy at the time was working on her, what was it called? When we had to write the letters home of like every, oh, confession letter.
Her confession letter. Yeah.
Yes. She was in the middle of writing her confession letter when she was my hope buddy. And I was like, what is that? And she explained to me what a confession letter was. And for those who don't know, who didn't go to a program, the confession letter was at a point in your program, you were to write a letter home detailing every wrong thing you were doing, everything bad you were doing, and, you know, taking accountability for it. And I remember her warning me and saying, you need to make sure you're honest in your confession letter and make sure it's really, really detailed, because if they don't have enough information in your confession letter, if you don't have enough things, you know, that you're admitting to, that you're confessing to, your family rep won't send it, and she'll make you rewrite it over and over. And I believe she was like on her like third or fourth time writing it. So that got through in my head really quick. I was like, oh, I will do my confession letter right away, and I'll make sure I'm super honest and put everything in there, because I wanted to get ahead of the game. I wanted to just go ahead and knock it out so I could get that phase over with and just go home.
Right.
Sure. I thought that's what I needed to do.
Right. If this is the way home, then I'm doing this. But I think you made such a good point, and I know you have more to say on this, definitely, but I think it's important to look at, this is how things are exaggerated. This is how things are fabricated that maybe didn't necessarily happen, right? We end up confessing to things that maybe weren't 100% true because we're trying to make it sensational enough to be appealing and appeasing to staff.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, to pour your heart out into a letter and say, okay, you know, and not only that, but at 16 years old to say, these, you know, this is what I did wrong at home. Let me tell my parents all about it. And then have a family rep tell you, nope, that's not good enough. You need to put more in there, or you need to add something else. What do you do when you don't have anything else to put?
Right.
You know, I went into, and, you know, minding my hope buddy's, you know, advice, heeding her advice, I was extremely detailed in mine, and it still wasn't good enough.
Mm. We actually haven't had anyone bring up confession letters yet, so I love that you kind of started out with this. But I think writing a confession letter also implies that, like, I'm the problem, right? Because...
Yes, absolutely.
Right? I mean, I think that, like, I can't confess that, like, yes, Mom, you were very stressful to me, and you had toxic traits of your own that you didn't work on. And so, you know what I'm saying? So it has to be fully, this is what I did. This is what I lied about. These are the nitty gritty dark secrets that I haven't told anybody. But it doesn't leave that space to discuss, how was the family dysfunctional that led to this behavior? What were the stresses that I was under and the things that I was coping with at the time? Like you said, depression and anxiety and trauma that you're sorting through. It doesn't leave space for that at all.
Right, exactly, exactly. Because then, you know, I can't say, oh, I'm just a child reacting to my environment, because then you're playing the victim. Then, you know, you can't play the victim. You have to take accountability for your actions.
Exactly.
And yes, in hindsight, I was a child who was lashing out because of my environment, because, you know, but I didn't realize that at the time. But yeah, that's an excellent point, that you are having to atone for things that may not necessarily be your fault, or you don't understand why you even did it.
Exactly.
You know, there are things that I, you know, my 16-year-old brain could not understand, because your brain's not fully developed in adolescence.
Exactly.
You know, so yeah, that's how I think that was definitely the start of having to not necessarily make things up, but to definitely, you know, add more to the story, you know, to the stories back home of how bad of a kid are you, kind of thing.
Right.
I should say too that I never made it past level two in my time at Ivy Ridge. I was there 13 months and never got off level two.
That's a long time to be sitting on level one and level two.
Yes. So I got zero privileges. I didn't do anything. I fought the entire time. I tried to play the game for a little bit, and by little bit, you know, time is such a strange concept there, because I was only there for 13 months, but it felt like an eternity. Now, you know, looking back, I'm like, oh, it was only 13 months. But back then it was like, that was infinite time. So I'm not quite sure how long I played the game. I know I went through, I know it was orientation, which is the first seminar that you go through, where I was like, oh, this is a bunch of bull. this is not right. So, and then after that, it was all downhill. I refused the program nonstop. It was so disheartening to work your way up, get what we only got like 10, 15 points a day. We were allotted if you were perfect behavior, and in just a blink of an eye, you know, I think the lowest denomination was 10, I believe, right? If I'm remembering that correctly.
Yes.
So you could literally wipe out a whole day's worth of points so quick, or end up in study hall.
Right. For nothing.
For absolutely nothing.
I just want to emphasize to people listening that it could be anything for any reason. It could be a messy braid that got maybe a little bit undone during the day, like slightly, right? Like some flyaway hairs. It could be anything that staff wanted to target you for. You could find something. Your feet aren't all the way together. You're slightly slouched. You drank too much water that day and you had to go to the bathroom too many times, and you get a demerit for that. I mean, there's so many made up things that could just wreck your entire progress. And like you said, when you're only acquiring 10 to 15 points a day, and then you get a demerit that wipes out 2.5 days worth of progress, it can feel incredibly defeating.
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes it wasn't even, you know, it wasn't even you. It was, you know, that there were dorm parents who loved to give, you know, the mass corrections to entire families just for the heck of it, you know, because it was like they got so much joy out of it. You know, that happened sometimes too, where it was just, oh, maybe 3 girls out of 10 did something, so now everybody's going to get a correction. It was rough. So needless to say, I spent a while in study hall.
Oh, man. So you spent most of your time in study hall. What was that like?
I felt comfortable because I felt the pressure was off. I still had to sit in a certain way in structured position. You wrote out the rule book. Sometimes they would throw the dictionary in there, like to write out the dictionary. I preferred to do that than to be constantly watched and screamed at if I, you know, missed a step. But I remember them stopping study hall and they were no longer doing it. I remember just getting put in intervention. An intervention was pretty much solitary confinement. On the girls' side, we had 2 rooms and that's where you stayed. You just stayed there until you could write an essay. Intervention is where they tried to break you. That's where they tried to break your spirit. You had nothing to look at. There was no more writing. There was no more even copying the rule book is mindless. At least I could write in cursive for this sentence and write in print for that sentence, and I'm reading something. In intervention, there's nothing. You're staring at a wall by yourself alone. No one's there. I think there's a dorm parent stationed outside, and sometimes there were upper levels stationed outside. They were firmly instructed not to talk to you.
Right.
There were staff who were kind, and when I was in intervention, would, you know, treat me well and talk to me. But that was rough. I was not going to work my program in any way. I had no desire to ever be an upper level because I knew how stressed out, how disheartening it was to just lose 10 points. I couldn't imagine being given freedoms like being able to shave and being able to wear makeup and being able to talk. I mean, above all things, you didn't have to walk in formation. You could talk whenever you wanted to other, you know, upper levels. I couldn't imagine going from getting in trouble for glancing out a window to given so much it's so funny when I say it, it's so much, you know, more responsibility just being able to talk and, yeah. you know, not walk in a straight line. I don't think I would have been able to handle being given privileges and then have them taken away, because I didn't see a single upper level who wasn't dropped or put on probation at all. It happened to every single one of them.
Absolutely.
And I think that was a tactic to keep them on their toes as well.
Oh, yeah.
To, you know, I think that was a power trip tactic by staff, like a don't get too comfortable kind of tactic, you know, that we can pull at any time to keep you afraid, to keep you compliant. And I knew that I would never be able to handle that. If losing a day's worth of points was going to feel that awful, I could not imagine how bad it would feel to lose everything.
Oh, it was devastating. I dropped, I think, more times than a lot of upper levels. I'm not aware of anyone who's beat my record. Maybe there's someone, I'm sure there is. I mean, I dropped a lot, and it was over stupid stuff, right? It was never over me being like breaking the rules, just be for ridiculous things that they would catch me on, or I would get a trend of consequences, right? So if you got three or more of the same consequence, that was then another consequence called a trend. As an upper level, you would drop. It was, you're so right. It was absolutely devastating, because you lost all your privileges. You lost the ability to talk. You had to put your hair back in a braid, and you had to go stand back in line with the family and just go back to what you had worked so hard to get out of.
Well, not only that too, I mean, yes, that as well. But on top of that, then you have the entire girl side watching and being, I remember when an upper level would come into a room because they had dropped and they're, you know, in formation and their hair's braided, and you would hear a gasp, mm-hmm. you know, like, oh no, she dropped. That too. I mean, that I was like, there's no way. I will never do this. I knew that I was in this program until I graduated the program. I knew I was not going to graduate the program. There was no way they could make me. So I was like, well, I'm going to be sitting here till I'm 18 years old. So basically I was just like, how do I want to spend the next, you know, year and whatever month? Do I want to even try and go through that stress and the ups and downs? Or do I just want to sit here? And so I was like, I'm just going to sit here. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I wonder if it would have been better to play the game and to try and to try to graduate and see if that was even a possibility. But then at the same time, you know, I'm kind of glad I did do it how I did it, because I know when I came out, I was somewhat brainwashed. Mm. I couldn't imagine how brainwashed I would have been if I had actually, you know, played the game. If I was brainwashed, and I had therapists, I'll talk about this later, but I had therapists, you know, telling my parents, you know, she's brainwashed. Like, there's something wrong here, after I got out of the program. And that was for me resisting. If I had gone along with it, I mean, I can't even imagine what I would be like.
I think you may make such a valid point, because in my journey, I was one of the ones who I went along with it. I mean, I was 14, so I had the potential to be there for 4+ years. And so I was right. Like, all right, I got to do this. I have to do it. There's some letters that I read now that I wrote back then. And it's the most bizarre feeling, because as I read these letters, I'm like, that's not me. Who is this person? It's so strange. That's so incredible that even though you were resisting, you were immersed in the environment.
Right.
The brainwashing is going to happen, because part of the brainwashing is the fear, right? The fear of getting in trouble, the fear of being restrained, the fear of going to intervention. That in and of itself is absolutely part of the brainwashing.
Oh, absolutely. Regardless if you resisted the whole time, like I did, or you played the game and graduated, still used the same tactics. They kept us, you know, malnourished. They kept us sleep deprived. They had reasons and methods for everything they did, you know, in that sense too. That was still a form of control. That was still a form of brainwashing, just to be able to have that power over you in that sense. I remember going through Discovery, which I think wasn't Discovery the next seminar after orientation?
Yes.
So Discovery is then when it really came crashing down. I chose out of Discovery three or four times I chose out. And for anyone who didn't go to a program, chose out means you were either told to leave or you just left, left the seminar. You weren't allowed to complete the seminar. If you can't complete the seminar, you cannot move up in your program at all.
Right.
I remember going into Discovery and feeling hopeful and feeling like, oh, this is going to be good. And I remember leaving feeling so torn up after I chose out. Mm-hmm. I ended up choosing out because the facilitator was Mr. Shane. I remember this clear as day. Mr. Shane kept saying that I was putting walls up. To try to impress Mr. Shane, there was one part of the seminar where you had to get up and speak about your past and stuff. And I was trying to impress Mr. Shane. So I got up and I started speaking. And I started speaking about the sexual abuse I endured from ages 4 to 7, you know, and how that impacted me. His response was to slut shame me for a child for being sexually abused. That was his response. And I know that my response was, excuse me. And he stopped because he was pacing and he stopped and he looked at me and said, excuse you. And I said, that's wrong. That's, it wasn't my fault. I was, I was a toddler pretty much. Yeah. I was in preschool. He started berating me, trying to get other standing in front of girls and boys, boys who I have not seen the opposite sex in months.
Right.
You know, girls and boys sharing these gut-wrenching details that I have never been able to disclose to even my parents. And he's going to slut-shame me for it in front of all these people. And then not only that, try to get other people, my peers, to join in.
Right.
And so I said, this is absolutely. It was soul crushing. I remember being like, said something along the lines of, this is ridiculous. This is wrong. And he told me, and this is what forever say in my brain, you are on thin ice. And I said, fucker, I just broke the ice. And I walked up and my butt was restrained for the first time outside the doors. And I was in intervention.
Wow.
Because it was,
defending yourself. Yeah.
Right. And to this day, I mean, I have 3 children and I told my son one time, I said, son, you're on thin ice. And I instantly paused and went into the bathroom dry heaved. But I could not believe that sentence had come out of my mouth, because that is a sentence that will forever be ingrained in me, that you're on thin ice. And I said, I'm fucking breaking the ice. We're done.
Yeah.
And that's when I lost hope. I said, this is ridiculous. This is not therapeutic. I even know that this is wrong. And so from then on, I fought and I was not going to do it. On top of that, because the facilitators who run the seminars are all part of, you know, an outside organization. They get emails, they get descriptions prior to coming to the facility. So I had a target on my back every single time I went, even if it was a different facilitator coming, I had a target on my back because I was someone who had chosen out of the seminar 2, 3, 4 times.
Right.
It showed. And I was one that was like, if I'm going to be provoked, then I'm going to be provoked. Eventually I did make it through. It was definitely a challenge.
There's just no words to describe how anyone, I mean, you don't have to be a psychologist or have an advanced degree to know that that's damaging to a child. Right?
It's
common sense. This is not, like I said, it's not something that you even need to have a college education to understand. Even in your mind, being 16 at the time, you knew that that was wrong.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, I had been in therapy for years prior to, you know, coming to the program. I had a basic understanding of how the therapeutic process is supposed to go, and slut shaming a rape victim is not on that process.
No.
In front of a group of people. So I was restrained a lot in my time there. That's a hard pill to swallow, because I worked in the mental health field as an adult, and we were trained when I had that job on how to properly restrain an adult. Mm-hmm. The do's and the don'ts and the repercussions is you don't do it correctly. That was so triggering for me, because girls I mean, I don't know about the guys, but the girls were restrained for everything. Technically, it's supposed to be what if you are a threat to yourself or others. There was a time where we were in line because the boys ate meals before the girls. And so the girls would have to stand in line with their knees locked, staring at the braid in front of you until the boys finished. Mm-hmm. And I remember one day the boys were taking forever. They were way late. Every girl family was standing outside waiting in formation, knees locked, just standing there. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying, fuck this. This is terrible. Like, this is stupid. And I broke formation. And they told me to go back in formation. And I said, no, my knee hurts. Before I knew it, wham, I was on the floor. And then I was in intervention. For a while, it was bedtime. Every night, it seems like, for a little bit, I was getting restrained. In preparation for that, they would put a male staff in the girls' dorm at the end with the night staff, just waiting, because chances were I was going to get restrained.
So I know that, please tell me if this is too triggering to discuss, but can you explain what that experience was like, being restrained? I think sometimes when we even use the word restrain, it can kind of take away from the real actual experience of what it's like, because it's much more like an assault and much less like a medical restraint, like how you said you would experience working in the mental health field. And I actually also worked in the mental health field as an adult. And so I got to see the correct way to do it. And I also saw the incorrect way to do it, even in the mental health system. But if you wouldn't mind just telling us, what was that like?
The best way to describe it would be almost like a football tackle. And when I can't remember when the decision was made to start bringing the male staff in to do the restraint, because it used to be the female. The females would restrain the females. And then somewhere in there, it changed where the female staff were not going to be the ones to restrain. They would just radio for a backup staff or for a male staff, and then the male staff would come running. And they never picked, you know, the skinny, tall ones. They always picked the, you know, 300, 400-pound ones to do it. And it was pretty much a football tackle down with zero regard for if your head's going to slam against the floor. And then they would almost, like, sit on you.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I was, at the time, you know, I was not... I was a little girl being crushed by multiple men who are on top of her, who has a history of sexual abuse. So that was triggering as well. And it was just, it blew my mind. I remember screaming, I can't breathe, I can't breathe. And they said, well, you're screaming so you can breathe. But I remember having them on top of me and what that felt like, have them breathing on me and, you know, their smells and their sweats. And it was that feeling in your chest that your breath is being taken away from you. They broke my toe one time during a restraint. I'm sure you remember the very pretty, you know, cinder block walls in dorm two. They took me down and my foot slammed up against the cinder block wall. During one of the restraints, and I was convinced they broke it. I was convinced my foot was broken, and I kept screaming, you broke my foot, you broke my foot. And one of them, and I would never ever be able to say who it was because I have no clue, took my left foot and said, your foot's not broken. And then it said, but it's going to be if you don't stop, and then twisted my toe. And from then on, still made me wear my ugly Mary Janes and put weight on it. So to this day, I mean, it's been 14 years. My toe is still pretty crooked. I mean, visibly crooked because of that. It just healed broken.
And I just, again, want to emphasize what you just said, because that highlights perfectly the mindset of these people. It was not about protecting you from yourself. It was not about protecting anybody else. It wasn't about protection. It was about domination. It was about control. It was about violence. We saw time and time again, these staff members taking out their own anger, their own mental torment on kids, exactly like what you just explained. by no means was this a safety issue. And like you said, people would be restrained for anything. If you talked back, if you got upset, if you had a strong emotional reaction to anything, you could be restrained. Absolutely.
Right.
And I think in that sense, too, it was so traumatizing seeing people being restrained. That was traumatizing as well. And I'm sure, you know, of course, even more so for the person being restrained. But I think all in all, it made us feel completely unsafe and powerless. We had no control over what would happen to us, our bodies, or to each other.
Right, exactly. And the staff knew that, because there were times where they would use that as a tactic to try to get me to comply. Like, they would say things, you know, after it was all said and done, look what you're doing to these girls. Look, these girls have been victimized at home. These girls know what real screams are, and look what you're doing to them. You're triggering them. You know, you're doing this. You. And in a way, I mean, I did put up huge walls, and I dissociated a lot while I was there. And so I'd be like, you know, whatever. It's that's not my fault, whatever. Inside, it killed me. It killed me, the thought of, did I just set somebody off? Is somebody else set off now because I screamed? And so I did, even though I tried to maintain this, you know, hardcore exterior, like, I'm not fazed, I don't care, whatever. It stung. That was the part, the part that affected me the most, when they tried to say I was doing something to other girls, like, right, triggering them with my screaming.
I mean, we can look now and see that that's gaslighting, right? That's gaslighting.
Right.
Physically assaulting someone and then saying, look at what you're doing to everybody else. That's complete manipulation and gaslighting. I'm so sorry that you went through that. And I'm sure that was on your heart and on your mind. That was also completely out of your control at the same time.
Right. And I understand that now, I think somewhat to an extent. I mean, that whole idea definitely followed me into adulthood. You know, I had my first marriage, because after years of domestic abuse. So I definitely, you know, saw a pattern in that of the gaslighting of, oh, you're making me do this to you. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that definitely, it became a cycle afterwards, with feeling blame, feeling guilt for someone else hurting me. That was definitely, you know, definitely something that followed.
Right. That's can be a very difficult shift for survivors of these institutions, to understand that it doesn't matter what I do, I don't deserve that. It doesn't matter how I hurt someone's feelings, I would never deserve to be hurt. Right. And
right.
I know for myself, I'm also a survivor of domestic violence. I saw how that extreme control and extreme gaslighting was also a part of the program. And so then, not even, you know, 2.5 years later, after I got out of the program, I was in this domestically violent relationship, and I didn't see the red flags, though. I didn't see it. And now, being on the other side, I'm now 30, I could be able to pick that out clear as day in anybody. But at that time, I think our minds were so warped, and we didn't have a solid sense of self, or a solid sense of even self-esteem or respect or expectations of how we should be treated. But what we did know is we had been taught to comply. We had been taught to obey, right?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. It definitely seems like a pattern. I think that's something that carried on potentially with the females, you know, after the fact.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I listened to Alex's podcast, the episode you did with Alex, and he did such a phenomenal job in depicting the boy side. But I think that the girl side was, you know, very different, in the sense that, you know, I never recall upper levels or, you know, other kids being put, you know, pegged against each other to fight, but we were messing with each other's minds.
Mm-hmm.
So much. I mean, I remember, you know, we had morning groups with our family reps, and you would sit in a circle. It happened to me a lot, because I'd come back from intervention having to go around in a circle, and that golden line of, my experience of you is, And that was basically your ticket to say anything you wanted to, regardless of how accurate or, you know, how truthful it was. And it seemed like if you didn't have an experience of someone, then you weren't working your program. You were not actively, you know, participating in the program, and you could lose points for that, you know, or it might be stunting because you're not working your program. We heard that a lot, you know, you're not working your program. And so you were, you know, I think the girls were kind of mentally pegged against each other. Unlike the boys who were physically pegged against each other, I feel like we were mentally of, okay, let's stand this girl up and let's go around in a circle and just point out things, whether they're true or not, because we have to say something.
Right.
So let's say something.
When people gave feedback, it was like they literally, that's what they called it, right? Just for anyone listening,
right,
they called
yes.
it, they called it giving feedback. And so one person who's receiving the feedback, and I actually just kind of remembered parts of this last night, but you would have to stand in an open position. So you'd have your feet shoulder width apart, you'd have your hands out by your side, palms up, like you were open, right? Your body is physically open.
Right.
And then people would stand in front of you. I mean, they could say the most horrific things about you. Feedback was all about finding someone's soft spot, finding something that's sensitive to that person, that's hurtful to that person, and completely exploiting it. If you didn't participate in that process, then they would consider that to be, you're not working the program. We can look back at different organizations that are no longer in existence, but we know that these organizations were heavily linked to brainwashing. They were heavily linked to cults, such as Synanon, CDU, Elon House, right? They all had different processes like that. Sometimes they called them rap sessions, and they would actually get physical, but it's the same setup. It's the same dynamic.
One tactic they used, so they could say, oh, we didn't do anything. The staff didn't do anything. That was all them. And then especially if you didn't have anything to say, because I mean, really, how much experience of one person can you have? We're not allowed to talk to each other. You're not allowed to even look at each other for the most part. I mean, I can't comment on the back of your braid. So this stuff wasn't always truthful, you know? So if one person said something and honed in on something, then it wasn't out of the norm for others to kind of follow suit and kind of talk about, you know, repeat the same sentiment over and over and over again, because there was nothing else to say. Now we're internalizing things that may or may not even be true.
And these kids are obviously, we were not trained in psychology. We were not trained in diagnosing people or behavioral health. Like, we knew nothing about any of that. And so essentially what it would come down to is, do I like this person or not? I mean, it just...
Right, exactly.
It just did. If you liked the person, then you would say, my experience of you is you're doing amazing and you're working your program. If you didn't like the person, then it was, my experience of you is that you're fake and that you're using this story about you being abused as a poor pity me victim story. And you would belittle people
right.
for their real experiences. I mean,
yes, absolutely. So I think that definitely played mind games on top of everything else. It's not our fault. It's not, you know, I don't hold anything against the girls that were there or anything that was said or anything along those lines, but it just goes to show how gross it was that they not only did the staff and the family reps and the seminar facilitators do this to us, they then had us do it to each other as well for points to excel. Because if you weren't doing it, you're not working your program, you know, you're not going to excel. You're going to tear this person apart, or you're going to, you know, sit and not excel in your program.
You also knew at the time. So first off, like you said, facilitators are a part of it. Family reps are a part of it. Other students are a part of it. Then you know that you are completely powerless. You have
right.
There's no room for resistance. If we're talking about human rights and consent, there was no option to even give consent. You either complied or you were restrained.
Right. You're not supposed to restrain someone unless they are a visible threat to themselves or someone else. I don't know of anyone dying because of an eye roll. And we were restrained for eye rolls. We were restrained for our knees not, you know, buckling. Mm-hmm. We were taken out by 300-pound men. Little girls were taken out by 300-pound men. you would see the men, the dorm dads, like, you know, huddled around after restraint. It was like a boys' club. Afterwards, it was so gross. Two or three dorm dads would stand outside the intervention room and, you know, high five each other about it and be like, "Oh, did you see that takedown?" Like, it was a sport. It was disgusting. This was fun for them. Taking the women out of the equation made it so much more worse, in the sense that there was no regulation, because those women, the dorm moms, were not regulating the dorm dads. The dorm dads are, we've already established, are, it's a sport to them. And then it's like they cop feels during the restraints, or they make inappropriate jokes during the restraints. They say something to provoke, because if you're a victim of sexual assault and you have multiple men on top of you, mm-hmm. you know, sweating on top of you, you know, touching you, and then they can make a joke about it, it's hard not to lose your shit.
Of course.
And they knew that. So it made it more of a sport of the takedown. It was fun for them. No one deserves that. No child deserves that. That was the only touch, too. And I think part of me missed human interaction so much that I was willing to trade. I was willing to be demeaned and physically hurt, sexually assaulted during restraints, just to feel a little human interaction. That is such an awful thing to admit to. And it's such a sad thing to admit to, that it went that far.
We see that kind of mentality and that kind of behavior in prisoners who are in solitary confinement for very long amounts of time, who have had no physical human touch. There's so much about even just hugging someone, or even as you're talking to them and you put your hand on their arm, even just having those little moments of connection do so much for us mentally and emotionally. And when we are starved of that, our human psyche is so hungry. I think that that is actually very common. I think that's very common for people to experience that after long amounts of time of isolation and just social deprivation. So what happened before you left? How did you leave, and what happened there?
My parents were very, very aware that I was not working my program, that I was not, you know, excelling in any way. I remember I finally was able to do PC1. For those who didn't go to programs, was your parents came to the facility, and the facility would they would turn the heat on and they would, you know, make it look comfortable, and everyone was to smile if you had interaction with parents, and you know, they put out fancy tablecloths and in the gym and stuff like that, and really souped it up. And the parents would come and do a seminar with their child. My parents came for PC1, and they saw me, and they saw how broken I looked. And, you know, and I tried to explain what was going on to them, and was instantly pulled out of the seminar room when I was trying to explain what's happening to me.
Wow.
My mom and dad went to the director of the girls' side and was like, "What are our options here? Is there another program we can send her to?" You know, they were looking at Cross Creek. You know, could we just send her to Cross Creek? And they let me come back into the seminar room, but were very, very, you know, hung around very closely. And I think my parents picked up on that, of like, you know, the staff are really surrounding. The next time we received mail after PC1, my mom had informed me that she was looking into other programs and looking into other options for me. I remember begging her that whatever program I went to was fine. I honestly thought I was going to Jamaica, because that was something that was threatened a lot. So I figured I was going on a plane to Jamaica and they're trying to get my passport together or something. At that point, I was completely broken. Nothing was going to faze me. I didn't care. I was sure I was going to die. I mean, this sounds very melodramatic, but I was positive I was going to die, whether it be at my own hands or a restraint gone wrong. Something's going to happen. I'm not going to make it out of here. And if I do, if I go to Jamaica, then it's the same thing. I'm not going to make it out of there. And that was just something I kind of accepted. Because of that acceptance, I was put on suicide watch. That was another thing. I was on suicide watch like almost my entire time there. And I'm not sure if that was an attempt because they would purposely, you know, go by and like kick my mattress to wake me up and stuff. So I don't know if it was like an attempt that to make it easier, I was more accessible to kind of keep me sleep deprived as a compliance tactic, or if it was because I had made comments before about, I'm already dead. Like, there's nothing you can do to me. I don't care. I'm dead inside. You guys have broken me. I'm dead inside. And they, you know, oh, she's on suicide watch now. We're keeping her in the hallway. So at that point, I kind of was like, whatever. I was welcoming of it, but at the same time, I was scared, but I was happy to get out.
Right.
It was like Groundhog Day, you know, of seeing the same people and having the same abuse. And I knew next week I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be in, my day is going to play out the exact same way it did today. I think I was a little bit welcoming of just any kind of change, even if it didn't mean go to Jamaica.
Right. That's so, also the dissociation, just being so dissociated right. That you're just like, I don't even give a shit where I go, just anything.
I was such a shell. I was not even a person anymore. They beat it out of me. There was no way I was, you know, I didn't feel like I was a human anymore. I felt like I was this monster because I was constantly being played against the other girls. I felt like I didn't, an outsider in that family. I felt like, you know, that was a pattern for me. I didn't feel like I belonged at home. I didn't belong here in this program. You know, I wasn't forming relationships with the girls in the program, and I wasn't forming good relationships with the staff. I took blame a lot. That this is me. I'm the problem with everything. I definitely disassociated in that aspect. I remember sending a letter home and begging my mom to just, can you know, not have a transporter to just come drive me herself. And I promised I wouldn't run because I think I was afraid of my experience with the transporters as well. But that was a definite no on her part. I knew I was leaving. I just didn't know when I was leaving. The day I got pulled, I remember radioing down and I remember just walking out. I don't remember feeling happy. I don't remember feeling overjoyed or excited. I just feel like I'm leaving now. That's what's happening. I'm leaving now. And I remember seeing transporters there in the lobby of the school. I remember seeing staff that had abused me while I was there making jokes. Like they look forward to reading my obituary. As I walked out, I got in a car with two transporters that were angels. They were absolute angels. They were sweet to me. They bought me food and even bought me a pack of cigarettes and let me smoke cigarettes in the backseat of the car, the drive down. I ended up going to another program. It was a residential treatment facility that was actually in a hospital in Virginia. So I was transported from Ogdensburg, New York to Virginia. And this program was phenomenal. There was actually licensed staff. It was nurses and therapists and activities therapists. It was great. It was such a breath of fresh air, but I feel like it was so foreign to me being there because we had our rooms with bathrooms in them and I didn't have to wear my uniform. You earned levels, but you earned levels quickly and could go on activities.
You were actually a person again.
Right, exactly. And I was starting to feel better about myself. I was starting to feel like people care about me. My therapist there, Miss Kristen, was a beautiful soul. She saw, I would tell her somewhat, you know, what happened, but it was so bizarre that I just couldn't put into words exactly. Like, I couldn't tell the story. And I don't understand, I still to this day don't fully understand why I couldn't just say what happened. There was none of the conversation of what, you know, you and I are having today. There was none of that. It was, I would give her bits and pieces, but there was just something there that I just couldn't. I wanted to, but there was no way. It was like a disconnect between my brain and my tongue. I just could not physically say what happened.
Do you think that you felt any kind of shame about what had happened there?
I think I did. I know that I took on a lot of guilt. Like, I deserved it. If only I had been good, this stuff wouldn't happen to me. So I think I did take on a lot of that guilt. And that could have been a reason why I didn't say everything. She did figure out fast that there was something wrong. I remember her telling my mother she's speaking like she's brainwashed. She's using terms that I, as a therapist, learned in, you know, grad school, and she's saying things that are weird. So she was the first one to kind of pay attention and validate that something happened here. They toyed with our brains here. And so she was the first one to ever kind of validate that for me.
Wow.
In that sense. No shock. Not long after that, I was pulled from that program and went home. At the other program I went to in Virginia, your parents were allowed to come. You were able to leave the grounds with your parents, you know, if they were local. My parents, you know, my mother lived in Massachusetts. So she, I think, visited twice while I was in Virginia. I realized that she blames me. She blames me. She's brainwashed. She loved the seminars. She thought they were fantastic. And oh, there's my stubborn, rebellious daughter. She didn't work her program. She didn't do it. And this is all her fault. This program would have worked if she had just worked it. So I had, I think, felt that blame and gotten it already that I started self-sabotaging big time because I did not want to go home at all.
I'm sure you're feeling like, oh, now I'm just going to be back to where I came from, which is maybe why I am where I am.
Right. Exactly. Like nothing was changed. We're, you know, nothing, if anything, it's gotten worse. There's no point of going home. One of the things I did at that new program was help the activity specialist. And so one time just she and I went to Target to buy things for the kids on the program. I don't know if it was intentional on her part, if she was trying to feel me out or if it was just purely accidental, but I remember, and it's burned into my brain, of her meeting in the aisle, looking at something in Target and then looking over it and realizing I was in the aisle alone. And, I mean, the smart, rational thing would be, oh, you feel anxious, go find her. She can't be far, go find her.
Right.
And my brain was so crazy that it... my first reaction was to just drop on the floor. I remember a boy who works there, he probably was the same age as I was, coming to me and saying, are you okay? And I just said, I don't know. I don't know if I'm okay. I don't know.
Wow.
So, and I remember her apologizing profusely for that afterwards. But it was, and then I was like, what is wrong with me that I can't even stand in an aisle at Target by myself without dropping to the floor? That was just my first gut thing was like, I don't know if I internalized, like thinking I was like, went back to restraints and just dropped or what was happening.
Right,
but
definitely.
It was,
I'm going to be in
bizarre
trouble.
Reaction.
Yeah. Right,
exactly. Yes, that fear. I'm in trouble. Get down before they take you down. When I did eventually go home, that did play, that anxiety of being by myself was terrifying to me. The friends that I reconnected with, I knew I drove them crazy because I was calling nonstop to be like, hey, come hang out with me, because I couldn't bear to be alone. For years. I could not stand to be alone. And I just went into the same pattern of trying to find affection and trying to find love and confusing violence and anger for passion, and it was just a spiral to, you know, until adulthood. It was a spiral for me.
Yeah.
I don't have anything to do with my mother. I haven't spoken to her in years, and that's probably for the best. Even coming home, she didn't want to hear anything about the program, and I, for a long time, still could not put into words what happened. I couldn't talk about my memories. Just me, myself, and then let alone just someone who was not willing to hear it and who blamed me. So I think it's probably for the best that she and I don't speak, because I think that in adulthood, I've been to therapy and I've rationalized this, and being a mother of my own, you know, being a mother myself, it changes you and you see how fiercely you can love your child and what the ends of, that you would go to the ends of the earth to protect your child. That's just not there with her. And that could have been disconnected before I even went. And that could have been disconnected after the fact, or even while I was there. I realize now as an adult that she has a plethora of mental issues herself and struggles with mental illness herself. And she might not be in a place that she can handle hearing the truth and hearing what happened. Right. And so I have to respect that too. I have to respect she can't bear. It's going to impact her life. It does stink. It stinks to not have a mother. Having children of my own, I went through having children and getting married and not having family there for me. That was rough. And that's where I kind of feel like sometimes maybe I should have complied with the program, because maybe then at least I would have that relationship with my mom. At least that blame would be gone. At least she wouldn't blame me for this.
Even then, there would have been something else. There would have been, right. We can go back and think if I would have done this differently, if I would have done that differently, maybe it all would have panned out. But I think that those issues were there before you went to the program, and they're of course going to be there after, because maybe you weren't the problem. Maybe it wasn't.
Right. Right. I 100% I agree. To this day, I still struggle with, Haley, you weren't the problem. You were, you know, you I take accountability for the mistakes I made. Trust me, I was not, you know, I was a firecracker of a child. I was not by no means an angel. I can agree with that. But I can also see now I was a hurt child. I was a hurt child who was trying her best to survive.
Absolutely.
So I reconnected with my father recently, because that was in a strained relationship for a while too. In lieu of Paris's documentary coming out, I reached out to him and just kind of put feelers out to say, hey, this documentary happened. She shares a lot of experiences that are similar to mine. You know, I would appreciate it if you would watch this. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely dreaded sending that text message to him. I mean, I wrote out a text message and then would delete it and then do it again and delete it and then would get angry. Like, why can't I just write a text message to my dad to say, watch a documentary? Why is this so crazy? So eventually he and I spoke on the phone, and it was such a great conversation. And I found out that he thought the program was crap, that he chose out of seminars. And he was like, this was bull. This whole thing was bull. And he didn't understand it. Mm-hmm. That was extremely healing and therapeutic for me to say, because they were scammed. I understand they were scammed. And we could sit here in hindsight 2020, Monday morning quarterback it and say how they could have done stuff differently and I could have done stuff differently. At the end of the day, I think all I wanted was validation that I need you to acknowledge that this stuff happened to me. And I need you to acknowledge that I'm 30 years old and I walked out the doors, you know, 14 years ago, and I still have nightmares every night. Every time I look at my feet, I'm going to feel sick because my brain's going to go back to when that toe was broken, or the smell of cotton candy perfume that wretched staff wore is going to set me off and I'm going to start crying uncontrollably. I understand not dwelling in past and not pointing fingers, but you need to understand that there were things that unfolded there that are going to affect me for the rest of my life. And I need you to hear me in saying that and apologize for that. He was, thank God, so much more receptive than I ever could have imagined with that, and supportive. So that was very healing for me. So even though I don't have that from my mother, at least I kind of got that from my dad.
Right. That validation is so incredibly important, because I think it's taken us so long to figure out ourselves what the hell happened. Once we start doing our research and we start educating ourselves, and especially working in the mental health field and seeing all of the protective measures that the mental health system has to protect consumers, to protect people in their care, and knowing that we had none of that at the time. Once we start putting our own puzzle pieces together, and like you said, even understanding your triggers, understanding why your feet bother you, understanding why that smell of cotton candy perfume bothers you, or many other triggers that I know a lot of survivors have, even seeing different brands of shampoo and conditioner, like White Rain that we had.
Oh, yeah.
Even the smell of cocoa butter will trigger me sometimes. Different things like that can be very emotionally disturbing, or dropping to the floor in Target and trying to understand, what is that about? Why am I like this? Why does this bother me? And so when we finally come forward to someone with all of this stuff that we've pent up for years and years and years, I understand how that can be so nerve-wracking and just anxiety-ridden in and of itself.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
I am so incredibly grateful for you, and I'm grateful that you are on this healing journey and showing yourself that compassion and just taking it one step at a time. So I just want to say thank you so much for coming on here, sharing your story, sharing your experiences. I know that there's so many people who have been to these programs that are going to listen to your testimony and they're going to instantly identify. So thank you so much, Haley.
You know, people who weren't even in the program, that they're starting to hear us. And that's so wonderful, because I think we were so convinced for so long that it was only us. It only happened to us. And then hearing that other people's stories in the same facilities or in the same, you know, or in the different programs under WASP was so similar. That in itself is so therapeutic for all of us too. Just hearing everybody that we weren't so alone with this, that a lot of us have these issues. I thought I was crazy for having nightmares and why can't I just get over it? But hearing everybody else have the exact same nightmares is incredible. Yeah. And so I'm excited. I'm hopeful to see where it goes from here with Breaking Code Silence and other survivors coming forward and sharing their stories. I really look forward to this.
Thank you.
And so thank you. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome. And we have so much power in numbers. And I think that even just within our community of survivors, if we can find some sense of normalcy, even if that normalcy is having nightmares, even if that normalcy is not being so sure of ourselves, and at least we're in it together, at least we have each other, and we can now start having this conversation and impact change. Because as we know, there are still places like this open. There are still methods like this being used. And for some reason, people haven't wanted to touch it with a 10-foot pole. And now we're finally rising up as adults, and not only healing our past selves, but healing the children that are going through this today. So thank you for your contribution to that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Haley.